is I want to go and I don't want to go. What happens when they get there this week?
Saturday at 6 on Radio Catskill.
From WJFF Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the quiet epidemic, chronic Lyme disease. Approximately 14% of the world's population may have it, but there's no way to measure the true extent of Lyme disease as doctors commonly misdiagnose or dismiss the symptoms altogether. We talked to the filmmakers behind the documentary, The Quiet Epidemic, about their 7-year effort to reveal the truth about the illness. The 42nd annual John Lennon tribute. John Lennon would have been 82 this year, and fans come together to remember him at the tribute show in Manhattan next Saturday the 8th. We'll learn more from Executive Artistic Director of Theater Within, Joe Raiola. Plus, Why I Farm, an exhibit starting today at the Narrowsburg Union. And the student journalists of Manor, Inc. are here with reports on the Catskill Art Society reopening and 4-H. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Days after Hurricane Ian made landfall in Florida as a Category 4 storm, flooding continues there and is getting worse in some communities on the Gulf Coast. The storm dealt a devastating blow to Naples and Fort Myer, among many Florida locations. More than 15 inches of rain fell in some parts of central Florida, flooding homes and roadways. In Osceola County, people are starting to take steps to recover. Congressman Darren Soto represents the area and describes the scene.
Flooding is definitely the biggest damage. We saw areas of the northern Everglades like Mill Slough and Shingle Creek flood over. Also areas of East Orange County as well, from the Little Econ, Lachachi. So Mother Nature really poured a lot of water on us, and some of that is still standing.
South Carolina today woke up to the aftermath of Ian, which arrived there as a Category 1, and is heading north today with heavy rain and winds at post-tropical storm strength. Russian forces in Ukraine have been repeatedly shelling the southern city of Mykolaiv. NPR's Jason Bobian says the city has been hit by multiple rockets every night for the last week.
So this is the morning ritual here in Mykolaiv. People come out to sweep up the broken glass from the missile strikes that hit overnight. These were residential buildings. They're about 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 stories high. All of the windows on this side have been blown out. There's a fire crew cutting down some trees on the other side to try to get access to another part of the building. Rescuers say that no one was seriously injured in this attack, although numerous apartments were destroyed.
NPR's Jason Bobian reporting from Mykolaiv. Fire crews battling the 2-month-old Cedar Creek fire in Oregon say they are prepared for hotter, windier conditions over the next few days. Brian Bull of member station KLCC in Eugene has more.
3 weeks ago, an estimated 3,000 Oak Ridge residents fled their homes when an east wind event expanded the Cedar Creek fire and reduced containment to zero. Now the latest fire weather outlook shows east winds exceeding 20 miles per hour with highs in the mid-80s. Kit Moffitt, an operations section chief, says they've assembled a surge task force,
including an additional hot shot crew in addition to the two we have, and some engines, some other resources to kind of bolster what we've got in place in case we have trouble with those east winds. We do feel pretty good about the removal of fuel along the containment feature.
Oak Ridge residents have returned since the last major east wind event and are at get-ready status. For NPR News, I'm Brian Bull in Oak Ridge, Oregon.
This is NPR. Millions of people in the UK awoke to sharply higher energy bills today. Vicky Barker reports from London that people are taking to the streets in protest.
Householders are being encouraged to burn their utility bills at protests planned in dozens of British cities. Hefty new government subsidies have reduced the October 1st increase in the price energy companies are allowed to charge customers from a planned 80% to 27%. But earlier energy price hikes still mean millions of British households will see their heating bills double this winter. Some of those burning their energy bills have also pledged to stop paying them, a practice the energy companies, the government, and many consumer advocates are trying to discourage. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
The Commerce Department says that in August, U.S. consumer spending was up slightly over the previous month, a sign the economy is holding on despite inflationary pressures on food, housing, and a variety of services. At the same time, an inflation measure closely watched by the Federal Reserve was up 0.3%. AAA is reporting that the average cost of a gallon of gas in California is now up to $6.30, more than a dollar more than it was a month ago. The national average is $3.80 a gallon for regular. Now Governor Gavin Newsom is asking state regulators to relax rules on oil refineries, allowing them to switch production to the cheaper winter blend ahead of schedule. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Katina Foundation, supporting the Asylum Seeker Advocacy Project, providing more than 100,000 asylum seekers in the U.S. with community and legal support. Learn more at asylum.news.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Lyme disease was first discovered in 1975, yet there's been very little progress for patients. Meanwhile, ticks are spreading the life-threatening diseases around the world. The CDC says that 500,000 people in the U.S. alone or more get the disease. Some 10 to 20% of those who receive a diagnosis and treatment remain sick after the treatment. It's a new documentary called The Quiet Epidemic, and the filmmakers disclose new medical data and scientific discoveries, most of which, the filmmakers allege, have been denied or misinterpreted by the Infectious Diseases Society of America and, by extension, the CDC, the National Institutes of Health, and the Food and Drug Administration. I spoke to the filmmakers of The Quiet Epidemic, which is screening today at the Woodstock Film Festival in Rosendale at the Rosendale Theater at 2:30. It's Lindsay Keys and Winston Crane Murdoch.
So in 2015, Winslow and I, after years of, you know, declining health and various symptoms, we had to move back home with our families to upstate New York because we couldn't support ourselves. We were so sick. And at my first Lyme specialist appointment, the nurse practitioner basically was like, "You're a mess." And how are you going to get through this? And she asked if I had a passion, because she said that patients who had a purpose tended to have better outcomes. So I said to her, I'm going to make a documentary film about Lyme disease. And she said that they had another patient there who was also a filmmaker with Lyme, who was my age. And I wrote a note to him, and it was Winslow.
Oh yeah, that's what started the whole thing. So I was one of my final appointments at this clinic, and I got this note, and I responded to Lindsay. And you know, at that point, we had both left our jobs, moved home, we're living on our, you know, with our parents. And so the beginning of this process was us just being very, very sick and trying to figure out kind of a way back into the world, career wise, and then also trying to understand the thing that we had just been dropped into. And it was incredibly disorienting to be young and to end up in this situation where you felt so terrible and you were hearing different things, from different doctors and being left choosing who to trust, and what path to take.
So the documentary follows a young girl from Brooklyn and a Duke University scientist. They're diagnosed with a disease said not to exist, chronic Lyme disease. But we've heard of chronic Lyme disease. Tell us a little bit more about the premise of this and how it's set up and how, what you've discovered.
Yeah, so we've all heard of chronic Lyme disease. We know people with chronic Lyme disease, but what people don't know is that when they have chronic Lyme disease, if they go to a doctor, most doctors are taught that Lyme is not chronic, and they are not allowed to treat people past 2 to 4 weeks of a standard antibiotic. And so if you happen to get diagnosed, and I say happen because the diagnostic test is not very accurate, but if you happen to get diagnosed and treated and you're still sick after even a month of antibiotics, doctors are not allowed to prescribe additional treatment. Otherwise, they risk losing their medical license because they're practicing outside of the quote unquote guidelines. So there's a very strict definition of what Lyme disease is, what it can do, how to diagnose it, and how to treat it. And for those people who fall outside of that very narrow definition, they are often left without help.
It seems so strange in this day and age that it's outside of a particular guideline. I mean, it's you hear about this all the time.
Yeah, and it's incredibly widespread. And so I think this film, 500,000 people a year get Lyme disease, get acute Lyme disease. And it's estimated that 10 to 20% of those people go on to have long-term lingering symptoms. And that group of people, 10 to 20% year after year after year is a really large and growing population, and they've been completely ignored. And so I think that what this really comes down to and what we talk about in the film is that the definition of this disease was solidified a long time ago, and the people who defined it are still sort of the powers that be in medicine, and they have not allowed for a broader definition of what this can do. Some of that has started to shift in the past couple of years. The CDC finally came around to saying that there is something called post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome, which is essentially suggesting that you were treated correctly for Lyme disease. You don't have acute Lyme disease anymore, but something's happening in your body and we don't know what it is. That was a step forward, but it was also a way to just give this a name, but also they haven't really done any research to look into what's actually happening to those people. And so I think it's a very similar thing that's happening with long COVID. We now see people that got acute COVID and they're progressing into this longer form disease. And luckily that is starting to be taken seriously. And so our hope is that by this renewed focus on the way in which these acute diseases can then morph into more chronic diseases, that some focus will also start to be paid to Lyme.
It is estimated that 14% of the world has Lyme disease, according to an NBC News report. Also, that Lyme disease has been found in all 50 states. You guys, in your documentary, kind of shed a light on, I don't know, is it Lyme shaming? Is it Lyme is a bad word? People, as you said, Lindsay, at the beginning, like your doctor said, oh, you're crazy, you're a mess. Like, is that sort of the culture which people have to deal with in this situation?
Yeah, a lot of people who have Lyme disease, if they mention it at the doctor's office, there's so much stigma and controversy surrounding it that doctors can become almost offended or in some cases combative because they have been taught that a lot of Lyme patients are just sort of malingerers and they're hypochondriacs. And really what it comes down to is, again, that the diagnostic test is not very good. And so for a lot of doctors, if they can't see evidence on a test in front of them, they don't really know what to do. And so it's tough. Both patients and doctors are in an awful situation because we need to be able to know who has it. But regardless of the bad diagnostic, there's no reason that people who are concerned they might have Lyme, given how widespread it is, to deal with such treatment from the people that they're seeking help from.
In fact, there's a recording late in the quiet epidemic where you hear a phone call received from someone at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, warning about spreading misinformation about Lyme disease in this regard. There was a vaccine on the market, but then was taken off. Where are we in terms of a vaccine and finding a cure?
Well, finding a cure, I would say we're pretty far from that. Research really hasn't been done because the disease hasn't been considered to be something that necessarily needs a cure. Again, I will say that this film is about the 20% of people that don't recover. And so if you catch the disease early and you get the right treatment right away, a lot of those people do really well. That is sort of this golden time in Lyme disease where you want to get the right drugs and you want to get them quickly. And unfortunately, our test is really, really bad. And so the test does not work in the first 4 to 6 weeks because it's an antibody test. And so it's measuring your body's reaction to the disease. And so that is kind of the gold time that you want to be able to know that you have it. And this test has been on the market for 40 years. And so that right there is a huge failing. It also doesn't, it's a bit controversial, but a lot of people don't think it works very well at later stages of the disease. And we've certainly seen that to be the case through the reporting that we've done. And so, yeah, the test is terrible. In terms of the vaccine that you brought up, the vaccine was put onto the market in 1998 and was pulled 4 years later in 2002. They claimed that it was 75% effective. You needed 3 shots. There was questions over, there was concerns around how safe it was. And in that period of time, there was a number of class action lawsuits, people who got really sick from taking the vaccine, and the vaccine was eventually pulled off the market. They claimed that there weren't any side effects and that it was pulled because of for profit margins, essentially. And so fast forward 20 years later, there is actually a new vaccine that's in phase 3 clinical trials through Pfizer. They just started putting shots in people's arms in Martha's Vineyard. You know, if that vaccine proves to be effective, I think that, you know, a vaccine against Lyme disease would be great. I think there, as we get into this in the film, there's a lot of questions around the previous vaccine and the technologies that were used. I think there's still questions around this vaccine and how similar it is to that previous vaccine that do need to be sorted out. Again, Lyme disease is such is so prevalent that having something like that would certainly benefit the people that haven't gotten sick yet. One thing to note on that is that, you know, you could have, there's people who believe that you could have an actual anti-tick vaccine, and ticks carry a lot more than just Lyme disease. And so I do worry somewhat that a just only Lyme vaccine would give people a false sense of security when they step out into the woods. There's ticks out there that carry other things and other things that can be really serious. The other thing I would say in that regard is that, of course, prevention is really key. But there's still this large group of people to which attention is not being paid and who are already sick. And so, yeah, it's a step forward, or it's a step in the right direction, but there's also needs to be research that goes into what's happening to these patients who stay sick and what we can do to actually get them better.
We're in a rural area of upstate New York and northeast Pennsylvania, the Delaware River Valley corridor. Ticks, Lyme disease, always top of mind for us here. So, you know, folks are continuing to pay attention. Broadly, though, do you think that COVID-19 and the pandemic brought more attention to chronic illnesses like chronic Lyme disease?
Yeah, I think that, you know, like Winslow said before, the fact that there are long COVID cases and many of them now, I think that's encouraging doctors to reconsider their definition of a cure, right? If someone is still so sick and debilitated and many patients disabled, just because they're not testing positive doesn't necessarily mean that they're cured, right? So we actually had a film critic show up to our premiere at Hot Docs in May, and he came in a skeptic, and I think he maybe thought he was going to drag our film, but he ended up, you know, being convinced basically that the intelligence of this bacteria, it makes sense that it could potentially survive antibiotics. And the way that he ended his review basically was saying that after going through COVID, information like what we share in the film lands differently now. So I think it's undeniable at this point that, you know, these common antibiotics and common antivirals that doctors have relied on for decades, in some cases they work, but we have to acknowledge that in some cases they might not work. And I think scientists should be excited by that, because that creates an opportunity to make really exciting and much needed discoveries.
There's an article where you were quoted as saying, Lindsay, there's a saying in the Lyme community, Lyme doesn't kill you, it just makes you wish you were dead. How did you guys survive this, and how are you doing?
Well, on that note too, I just want to add that there's such a focus in our medical system on death. It's like if a disease is mowing people down, then it's taken seriously. And yet you have all these people who are really suffering. One of the main causes of death in Lyme patients is suicide. A 22-year-old woman in Canada, her story is going viral right now because her father is a prominent businessman. She just killed herself, and that happens every day. And just because the disease doesn't kill people quickly doesn't mean that it's not serious or deadly. And so, yeah, I mean, for Winslow and I, we are definitely healthier than we were when we first met. It was a really hard process, making this film while we were so sick. But I think the nurse practitioner was right, what she said about having a purpose. You know, I think it helped to have something to live for that was bigger than myself. And even still today, you know, we do you always live with this question mark around, like, kind of like the boogeyman that follows you around. There's always a possibility of relapsing, and that's really frightening because you don't know if, you know, you get another illness or if you just get run down or if something, you know, if there's a big emotional trauma in your life and your immune system takes a dip, you don't know if suddenly you're going to be right back to where you were, you know, after 7 years or 15 years or however many years of treatment. And so that's really frightening. And I think that, yeah, right now, you know, Winslow and I, we're on the road, we're touring the film, and we look like we're just like two young, normal filmmakers. And yet we have this invisible illness and history. And we hope that the film can really make it visible for all of the people who are being denied and maybe even just overlooked. You never know what battle someone is fighting on the inside, even if they look perfectly healthy on the outside.
We've been talking to co-directors Lindsay Keys and Winslow Crane Murdoch of the provocative new feature documentary, The Quiet Epidemic. It's about chronic Lyme disease. It's screening this afternoon at 2:30 at the Woodstock Film Festival at the Rosendale Theater in Rosendale, New York. Additional screenings include the Hamptons International Film Festival, October 7th through the 16th, and the New Haven Documentary Film Festival, October 13th through the 23rd. Lindsay and Winslow, thank you so much for joining us. And on your website, thequietepidemic.com, there's even ways folks can take action about chronic Lyme disease, contacting reps, sharing stories, and even hosting a screening.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, take action and follow along. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with a preview of the annual John Lennon tribute. This is Radio Chatskill.
This is Kai Wright. I grew up in the Black Church, and my favorite part of service was the fellowship. The hugs and winks, just check-ins with all these people. I want to create that fellowship on the radio. Every Sunday evening, I hope you'll join me for Notes from America, a live national show. It's a place we can gather to share experiences, process, and figure out where this country is going together. Join me and join the conversation. Sunday evening at 6, live on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill and Catskill Brewery present Apple Pie Palooza, Saturday, October 8th, 5 to 9 p.m. at Catskill Brewery in Livingston Manor. Eat pie, win pie, bring home pie. Enter the Apple Pie Baking Contest at WJFFradio.org. Plus, dancing in the tent with WJFF's DJs, Jason Tuga, Nick Forte, and me, Cassie. Apple Pie Palooza, October 8th, benefiting Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. John Lennon would have been 82 this year, and fans will come together to remember him at the 42nd annual John Lennon Tribute Show in Manhattan next Saturday, October 8th. It's the longest-running John Lennon tribute concert in the world and the only ongoing event of its kind to be sanctioned by Yoko Ono. All proceeds support Theater Within, a nonprofit behind the John Lennon Real Love Project, a free songwriting program for public elementary schools and a free songwriting workshop for children, teens, and adults impacted by cancer. Radio Catskills' Jason Dole spoke to Joe Raiola, Executive Artistic Director of Theater Within.
Thank you so much for joining us, Joe. Your association to this John Lennon tribute goes all the way back to its beginning in the summer of 1981, and I think that would have been the summer after John Lennon was murdered, and you were involved in planning a reading of a new play called Show Me the Way to Strawberry Fields. Can you talk about how that evolved into a tribute?
Wow, you've really done your research. I'm not asked about that that too often. I was a member of an experimental theater group back then called Theater Within. And Theater Within was on 72nd Street, just down the block from the Dakota. And when John died in December of 1980, we took it really badly. And we wanted to do something to remember John. So one of the members of the group was working on a play called Show Me the Way to Strawberry Fields. And we were going to do a reading of it. And the play was loosely, it was about two couples and the impact that Lennon's life had on their relationship. And I was cast in it. And long story short, about a month before the planned reading, the playwright got cold feet. He didn't think that the play was ready yet, and he pulled it. So we had already promoted it. We wanted to do something to remember John in the neighborhood. So we decided rather than cancel the event totally, instead of doing the reading, we would do an annual John Lennon tribute. I'm sorry, a John Lennon tribute. We had no idea that it was going to be an annual event then. And a bunch of poets and dancers and musicians and storytellers got together, and it was impactful. I mean, we felt this was a really important thing to do, so we decided to keep it going, and 42 years later, it's kind of evolved into really the longest-running John Lennon tribute in the world, as you mentioned, and really kind of the official John Lennon tribute in New York City, which is a beautiful thing.
And, you know, about almost 20 years into this 40-plus year journey, that you turned into a charity event right around 2000. How did that happen?
Well, Theater Within was founded by a Russian immigrant who was my teacher and a theater director named Alec Rubin. And Alec and I produced the tribute for 20 years, and Alec directed it. And he retired in 2000, leaving it to me. And it was a small workshop production for those years that never made any money. We usually lost money. Maybe one year it made $50. I'm not sure. But I decided when I took it over that, you know, a Lennon event should be a charity event. That just made sense. So turned it into a charity event for an education program for children living in transitional housing at the Harriet Tubman Center in Harlem. And we just started making money and giving it away.
That's the best thing to do with it. What has Yoko Ono's involvement been? How's Yoko Ono been involved?
Well, that's a kind of interesting story. This event really flew under the radar for a long time. We weren't promoting it widely. And in its 24th year, in 2004, there was a little blurb about it written in the Daily News. And one of Yoko's assistants, Willa Shallot, Jean Shallot's daughter, happened to see the blurb, and she called me. She tracked me down, and she said, "What are you doing?" And I got to tell you, I was a little nervous. I said, "Well, it's John Lennon tribute." And she said, "Well, what's that?" And I told her, and I explained that it was a benefit for this program for kids living in transitional housing. And she said, "Oh, my God, that is really so beautiful." And the next day, I got a note from Yoko inviting me to write an essay for a book she was curating called Memories of John Lennon. And she asked me to write an essay for that book, which I did. And the book came out the next year on the 25th anniversary of John's death. And that kind of was a game-changing thing. Then I actually got a chance to meet Yoko's team, and the tribute ever since then has been sanctioned by the John Lennon estate, and Yoko's involvement has been really a kind of a game-changing thing.
We're going to continue this conversation, but I do just have to pause and go back and just reflect on, I think that's so New York City that you say Jean Shallot's daughter made the connection between you and Yoko Ono. That's very, very New York right there. I like that.
Yeah, I never actually met Willa, but she played a very big role in my life for sure.
So it's kind of even over all these decades, it's changed, become a charity event. It's raised its profile. What's the reaction from artists and fans and the people who've been involved with this been? How are they taken to this?
You know, as I like to say, the spirit of John Lennon lives in the heart of New York City, and it's really true. I know Lennon is loved around the world. However, I think he's loved in New York in a very special way. Of course, the mosaic, the Imagine Mosaic in Central Park is something that people all over the world visit. Artists from Patti Smith to Jackson Brown to most recently Ani DiFranco, they want to play Lennon songs. And they themselves feel a special connection to Lennon, who's influenced not only their music, but their worldview in so many ways. So I've learned over the years that when you get people together and you put them in a room and you sing John Lennon songs, they get happy. And it's a real powerful thing. And I continue to be amazed year after year the kind of impact that this event has. It's a it's still a deeply moving event, and it really packs an emotional wallop still after all these years.
And there's a beautiful quote up on your website. I want to ask about Joan Osborne's involved this year and is an honoree. And there's a beautiful quote on your website from Yoko Ono that says, quote, "For many years, Joan Osborne's beautiful voice has touched our hearts. I am in great admiration of Joan's support of charities that provide health care for women, assistance for children affected by war, and so many others." So what's the Joan Osborne connection, and what will actually be happening this year?
Well, Joan is playing the tribute this year. This is remarkable, for the 10th time. Wow. No artist has played the tribute anywhere close to that often. Joan first played the tribute in 2009. She's helped raise its profile in an enormous way. She's a great friend of the organization behind the tribute, Theater Within. And, of course, Yoko's quote is referring to a couple of things, I think. Joan has a long history of being a supporter of Planned Parenthood, which seems especially relevant now, given the recent Supreme Court decision on Roe versus Wade. And I think the other reference Yoko's making there is probably to Joan's involvement with some benefit concerts put together by All People Pavarotti that were benefiting children impacted by war. And I know Joan was involved in that. She's been involved in many other charities as well. So I think specifically that's what Yoko is referring to there. And in terms of the Joan being our honoree, since 2014, we've been awarding what we're honored to call actually the John Lennon Real Love Award, and it's given to an artist each year, not only for their lifetime creative achievements, but on their social impact or charitable impact. And Joan is this year's honoree. So the way that works is the honoree is chosen by the annual John Lennon tribute team, and then it's submitted to Yoko for her final okay, and we're just thrilled to be honoring Joan. It's long overdue.
That's great. And this happens, it's the 42nd annual John Lennon tribute, and it's happening Saturday, October 8th at the Peter J. Sharp Theater. And there's going to be multiple performers there. There's also Martin Sexton, Catherine Russell, Willie Nile, Larry Campbell, and Teresa Williams for a further Catskills connection down there in New York City.
Yeah.
We saw Larry and Teresa play a phenomenal show with Phil Lesh at the end of the summer at our own Bethel Woods up here. And the Kennedys, great. Looks like a great bill. And that's happening on October 8th.
October 8th, as you mentioned, that's the Peter J. Sharp Theater at Symphony Space, which is at 95th and Broadway. And it's also cool to be doing it on the Upper West Side, which, of course, was John's neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's something I wanted to ask you about. And you already hinted on this because you said, you know, the spirit of Lennon is alive in New York City. But if you go to New York City, you spend any time like on the west side of Central Park, like you can see like the Dakota. You can see where Yoko Ono lives. And I know, you know, times that I was in the city, you'd be like, you know, hey, I'm in New York. Yoko Ono's here. Or, you know, David Bowie's here. Lou Reed lives here. What was it like in the 80s? Because we could talk about, you know, Lennon's passing and his legacy. But what was it like working at a theater, being an artist in New York City, right down the block from where John Lennon lived at that time?
You know, we were deeply inspired by John and Yoko both. In our studio, I remember we had the we had the Plastic Ono Band, the album cover hanging in the studio. The back cover was a photo of John as a five-year-old. And that was meaningful to us because it was this other somewhat unusual connection between our theater group and John and Yoko. The founder of Theater Within, as I mentioned, was Alec Rubin. And Alec, actually, he was really a maverick. He was a theater director, and he was also a primal therapist. And back in those days, primal therapy was kind of the rage. There was a book called The Primal Scream written by Arthur Janov. And John and Yoko famously actually went into primal therapy in 1969 or 1970. And the result of Lennon's work in primal therapy was the album he called Sergeant Lennon, his first solo album, John Lennon Plastic Ono Band, with all those emotionally riveting songs, Mother and Hold On and Working Class Hero and I Found Out and all of that. So we were inspired by John, not only because he was a great artist, but because he was really delving into himself and expressing himself fully. There was a kind of nakedness in his work that we really admired, and we saw ourselves as doing our own version of the same work. So there was a very powerful connection, and that John was in our neighborhood and that he was a neighbor was just deeply meaningful to us. And again, it speaks to why we took it so bad when he was so senselessly killed.
Yeah. It means something to me. I don't know what it means. It means something to me that, you know, that John Lennon adopted New York City the way he did and that New York City adopted him. And I think it's amazing to see all these decades later that you're still not just doing this tribute, but building on it and just spreading the good work and the good vibes.
That's right. And I think that the reason we're able to do that is because John's music was timeless. And the message is timeless. Peace, love, equality, brotherhood, sisterhood. That stuff never gets old. It may sound like a cliche, but of course it's not. It's what we're all striving for. And Lennon expressed these values in a very powerful way, as few artists ever have.
Do you have anything else you want to say that we didn't get to?
You know, LennonTribute.org is your place to go for tickets. And you could also check out videos there from past tributes. We have some great performances by Natalie Merchant and Patti Smith and Joan Osborne herself. So LennonTribute.org, your place for tickets for the 42nd Annual John Lennon Tribute.
All right, Joe Raiola, Executive Director of the Theater Within. I want to thank you so much for taking the time with us.
Jason, thanks for having me on. Always fun to talk Lennon.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Why I Farm is an exhibit of intimate personal words and images of our area farmers told through interviews and photos. It starts today and runs through the end of the month at the Narrowsburg Union. I spoke to the photographer and co-creator of the project, Woody Goldberg, about how it came to be.
My wife and I have been in the upper Delaware. We have a second home for almost 40 years, actually over 40 years. I live in Brooklyn, was born in Brooklyn, and driving around the area over the years, I've so admired the landscapes and particularly the agricultural landscape. And talking with my wife, Janet Poppendick, we came up with this idea of taking photographs and interviewing farmers. And I know Rosie Starr, and so I immediately thought of her as someone to work with. And I've had a couple of shows with Pat Carullo in the Union Digital Gallery since he was open. I did something called Backyard Brooklyn, where I took photographs in people's backyards, and also the Catskills Spaces and Places, where I drove all over the Catskills taking photos.
Well, certainly you have an affinity for the Catskills area. What was it about the farmers in particular that drew your eye and wanted you to create this exhibition?
I'm an urban guy. Like I said, was born in Brooklyn. You know, thought this would be really a really interesting thing to do. So that's, and I asked Rosie about it. We started talking about it like in April, and we actually started it in May. And of the three of us, I had the easiest job. I mean, I just took photos. Rosie Starr did the, you know, she contacted the farmers, she interviewed them, and she really got them to talk about their motivations, their experience, what it was like. And for me, it was an eye-opening learning experience to hear and meet these folks. I mean, one of the first things I realized was I do not know the meaning of work. These people work so hard, and their knowledge is unbelievable. They're like scientists. They're mechanics. They have so much knowledge. It was really amazing to me. I have a new appreciation of what it's like to be a farmer.
Were you there when Rosie was doing those interviews, and what were some?
I was.
Yeah.
We were there together, and Rosie was unbelievable in getting the people to talk. They were ready to talk, but she really asked them questions, and she really, really got them talking and describing what their lives were like and how they felt about farming.
Do you think that our farmers in general are kind of underappreciated, that people just see them on the side of the road and think, oh, okay, they're just tilling the soil? There's so much more.
Urban folks, I think, do not understand what the work is like and how much knowledge you have to have. And, you know, it was amazing to me. They're like scientists. They're like entomologists, botanists, veterinarians. I mean, the skills and knowledge are incredible.
You talked to, it looks like, around 9 or 10 folks from Ant Hill Farm all the way to Will-O-Wisp Farm in the area, old,
yes.
New. What do you hope people take away from the Why I Farm exhibit at the Union Digital Gallery?
Well, I hope that we're able to convey how I felt in listening to these people and just coming away with the sense of knowledge that they've got and a sense of the kind of work that's required and the dedication to, you know, feed the rest of us. And again, these were small farmers, not big, you know, agro business types. I think it was really a positive experience too, because I think there is a sense of optimism that, and a sense that they're making a contribution, that the farmers feel this. And I do think they are grossly underappreciated in the urban environment.
It's Why I Farm, 9 5-minute audio presentations, 300 photographs. It runs at the Narrowsburg Union Digital Gallery through October 30th. There's an artist reception Sunday, October 9th at 2. We've been talking to photographer Woody Goldberg. Woody, thank you so much for sharing this information about this great project.
Thank you so much.
We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, the student journalists of Manor, Inc. take over and bring you some of their stories. This is Radio Chatskill.
Our music sale is the Saturday after Thanksgiving, and we are still taking donations of all things musical. Right now, we really need some high-quality vinyl. LPs in great shape, collector's items, or even some rare records. We also need stereo equipment, turntables, and receivers in clean working condition. Support local public radio while making sure no one leaves the music sale empty-handed. Donate to the music sale. Email manager@wjffradio.org. Thanks.
From WJFF, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Michelle Adams-Thomas, Editor-in-Chief of Manor, Inc. Manor, Inc. is the youth-driven, community-supported monthly newspaper published by the Livingston Manor Free Library. And today, we will be bringing you some of our stories. On today's show, 4-H. It's animals, yes, but also much more. Manor, Inc.'s Zoe McGee interviews 4-H's Barbara Morin. But first, our cover story. The Catskill Arts Society reopens this month after more than 2 long years. CAS will unveil its grand new exhibit rooms, performance space, and classrooms to the community in a day-long celebration on October 22nd. Manor, Inc.'s Nevaeh Roberts spoke to the gallery director, Sally Wright.
We've always had dreams of and ambitions of expanding to the second floor. The building has the biggest footprint on Main Street and was formerly a seasonal movie theater from the 1920s to 70s. So it's always been a cultural bedrock for our community. And with renewed enthusiasm and support, we've been able to fundraise so that we can expand to the second floor to make 2 new exhibition spaces, as well as a multi-purpose performance space. So renovation has been stop and go. Much of that met with hurdles and obstacles from the pandemic. But we are thrilled. We will be reopening October 22nd. In our newly expanded state, we're going to be showing work by James Turrell, Saul LeWitt, Francis Cape, and Ellen Brooks. We will have long-term presentations from James Turrell and Saul LeWitt. James Turrell's work, Avar, from 1976, is coming to us on loan from Seattle Art Museum. So it is one of his early apertures. So it looks like it's a flat rectangle on the wall, but the more time you spend with it, it feels as though it's this endless void. James Turrell is an artist of pretty significant international renown. He's been the recent subject of a major retrospective at the Guggenheim and LACMA, as well as most recently a big exhibition at Mass MoCA. Saul LeWitt is also a conceptual artist, so in that way, he writes like instructions, and they can be as simple and as descriptive as make 100 straight lines on a wall, or increase the distance between the lines at about 1/8 inch, if possible, adding arcs to the straight combinations of grids, arcs, and circles. All of these different prescriptions that are then drawn directly to the wall, which is really interesting. So we're going to be installing 2 of his wall drawings. And that is being installed by local artists starting Wednesday. This is kind of similar to one of the works which we're going to be showing. And he thinks of it as a real collaboration between himself and the installers. Saul LeWitt has since died, but his estate has sent over a draftsperson who's going to be overseeing this. So these are household names for a lot of people. Actually, both Saul LeWitt and James Turrell are on view at Mass MoCA, which is a major rural museum that's based in Western Massachusetts. And we're so excited to have these presentations and establish CAS as a real regional arts destination in bringing world-class art to our rural community. I haven't spoken about our name change. So we will be reopening as Catskill Art Space. Okay. In doing so, we of course want to speak to our newly expanded venue, but also the expansive nature of our programming. That includes not only the visual arts, but also performing and literary arts. And think of CAS as a conduit and a space for artists and art enthusiasts alike to share. Society also feels a little insular or stuffy, and we want this to feel like a really open, welcoming space. To kick off our performance space, we are going to be having a dance residency. So we are in our fifth year working with the Dance Gallery Festival, and we invite young choreographers to come up and workshop new work. So they will bring with them their dance company and create new dances, which will then later be presented on our opening day. In addition to the long-term presentations, we're going to be showing work from Francis Cape, who's a Narrowsburg-based artist, and he has made 10 benches that are inspired by communal societies. And all of them are tributes to those communities, but also as a whole are really speak to the importance of communal exchange and participation. So they will be on view in that space and can be used to sit out and look into the back view of the Willowemoc River, but they also can be used for programming as long as it's a shared, non-hierarchical way. So if I'm giving the talk, I cannot be standing and have the audience sitting on the benches. Everyone has to be sitting together in the collective round, which I think is a nice sentiment and also really interesting because he's, again, from this area. And then Ellen Brooks, who's a Livingston Manor and Brooklyn-based artist, is going to be showing historical and new photographs and sculptures. She photographs images of leaves and trees that she finds on the internet through this theatrical scrim. And then after photographing it through this veil, which distorts the image in a way, she then goes in with Photoshop and takes away even more. And as you look at it at first, you know, the trees and leaves, they'll kind of look like they're decaying species, you know, be it from wildfires or invasive species or just the changing of the seasons. But it's really a message on loss and change that we've all felt so acutely in the past few years. Ellen will be on site to ask any questions. We're going to have a talk from Oliver Schultz, who is the curatorial director at Pace Gallery. He also worked at MoMA PS1 with James Turrell, so he's going to speak on James Turrell. And then Francis Cape will be speaking on his utopian benches. And then the Dance Gallery Ardsley Residency presentation.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill, the Manor Inc. edition. I'm Michelle Adams Thomas, Editor-in-Chief of Manor Inc. 4-H is the largest youth organization in the nation, and today is the start of the new 4-H year. Manor Inc.'s Zoe McGee spoke to Barbara Morin, 4-H's program manager at Cornell Cooperative Extension, about her perspective on 4-H.
What are some of the things that most people don't realize about 4-H?
I think most people don't realize how diverse 4-H is. So, you know, there are some core things that we do in 4-H. We ask that kids participate in public speaking, right, which is our public presentations. They do a record-keeping page so that they learn the skills of record-keeping. We offer a lot of science or STEM-based activities where I think that the perception is people think that 4-H is just livestock and showing at the farm, but it is so much more. Yes, we do agriculture and food. Roscoe School, I did a program last year on healthy living and incorporated in different products and exercises and things that kids should know, right, about healthy living. So the curriculum and the lessons just go on and on and on. So if you're interested in it, environmental science, forestry, you will be able to find it through 4-H.
What is the plan for this 4-H year?
We are in person. We are currently just finishing up our 4-H year, which ends in September. And starting out in October, we're going to be dabbling in some new programs. Again, I just got some fun stuff about learning about the ocean and diving in with some ocean curriculum. So I have a lot of kids, you know, I teach animal science also, and I have a lot of kids that come to the farm and they want to be marine biologists. So I'm going to pull them in and they're going to give me a little hand with this STEM activity. I'm looking to really grow the projects and the participation, maybe through the schools or through after-school programs where we can develop crafts or fiber products or plants, do some horticulture, where kids can participate in our so you know our grand finale is the fair at Grahamsville, and we look for people to put their projects that they did in school. So maybe someone did a great painting or a ceramic project, or we had some kids do kits where they put together trucks or tractors, painted things, made crafts, sewing, any baking, any of that is considered a 4-H project. And so we have the rubric for it and the curriculum, and you follow along, and then you could participate in the 4-H program out at the Little World Fair. So I try to base our programs where it will be interactive. So we had we hosted a horse program at my farm in Jeffersonville. We had about 20 kids come out to learn about horses. The next one hopefully is going to be down towards Calicoon at Deal Me In. So we try to rotate that. The dog program that's coming up, again, knowledge-based but interactive. And we have poultry program. We have a very strong poultry program here in the county where the kids raise their chickens, learn some entrepreneurship possibly by selling their eggs or showing their birds. And they come out to the fair, obviously, and keep records on all of this. So they learn money math and they learn responsibility and the life cycle, because they can incubate the eggs and watch them grow to hatch. So that program is going to be on a Saturday night once a month. And again, interactive learning, but you can choose any of them. Or we have this fiber arts. And so that's where they're going to be learning crafting and using fibers. So it's a lot of fun.
Where can people find more information about 4-H?
So people can go to the Cordell Cooperative Extension of Sullivan County website, or CCE Sullivan, and go to the 4-H tab, and it will take you to where we have things updated and the forms available for membership. Also, we have a Facebook page. Sullivan, CCE Sullivan Facebook page, and that's where you'll see lots of the programming coming up and can grab a hold of the times and where they're going to be. We are going to have a membership drive. It starts October 1st. So that means that we have an open enrollment. So it means that at any time during the year, a youth could join anywhere from 5 to 19. But the year actually starts in October. So if you want to do a project, say I'll use a beef cow, for instance, because it takes a long time to grow a beef cow. If you wanted to start in October with your cow and you keep the records and you work with it, et cetera, et cetera, you want to get signed up in October. Oh, I forgot. One of the benefits of 4-H is that if you don't have any of these animals, but you love it, there is a leasing program as well. That if we find someone who has them and is willing to lease it to you, you also don't have to own. You can lease.
That's all for Radio Chatskill, Manor Inc. Edition. Special thanks to Kelly Butcher, Diana Fredenberg, Marge Feuerstein, Audrey Gauro, Chelsea Harlan, Amy Hines, Art Steinhauer, and David Dan. You can find more information about Manor Inc. at manorinc.org. Radio Chatskill, Manor Inc. Edition, is produced in partnership with WJFF. I'm Michelle Adams Thomas. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Jeffersonville Farmers Market, featuring local farmers, producers, and purveyors. Summer Sundays, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. next to the Jeffersonville Bake Shop on Main Street. JeffersonvilleFarmersMarket.com. From Superfine Social, custom Squarespace websites plus social media and digital marketing coaching for small business owners and community organizations. Take control of your online visibility. SuperfineSocial.com.
Farm and Country is coming up next, followed by Catskill Character and the Janice Adams Show. The forecast for the Catskills in northeast Pennsylvania, considerable cloudiness and occasional rain showers this afternoon, high around 55. Slight chance of a rain shower tonight, cloudy, low of 47. Tomorrow, overcast with a slight chance of a rain shower and a high of 54. At the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty right now, it's 55 degrees at 11 o'clock.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233 AH Monticello.
Public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Radio Catskill.